This is Meditation in the City. I'm Dave, your host. This is episode 100, and it's also Pride Week. Shambhala, New York, and members of the Queer Dharma community at the center presented a special panel discussion this past Wednesday called Queer Confidence. This was obviously in the wake of the recent mass shooting in Orlando. The panel included filmmakers David Thorpe and Eric Rocky. And you know what? Actually, the panel begins with all the introductions, so we'll just roll the tape. As always, visit us at ny.shambhala.org to see all our upcoming community events, weekend retreats, and meditation classes. Shambhala Training Level 1, the weekend of July 15th, is a great place to start. Click the link on the homepage for more information. And now, to kick off the panel, here's senior Shambhala teacher Acharya Eric Spiegel.
My name is Eric Spiegel. My teaching title is Acharya. I'm the senior teacher here and have been a member of this community most of my life, having met my first teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, at about the same moment I was coming out and turning 19. And I've been part of those two communities, the Shambhala community and the gay community, for all of this time, and have made a variety of forays into combining the two, and I just am really glad that Georgia actually came up with this idea and that we were able to invite these wonderful guests from a variety of traditions and backgrounds, and that you all have shown up. And I just wanted really to welcome everybody on behalf of Shambhala and welcome our friends here. And we have a very full evening, so we'll just move along. Thank you.
Thank you, Acharya Spiegel. So I'd like to take a moment to introduce our panelists. Start here with Eric Rocky. Eric is a director. He's the director of Pink Boy. Pink Boy is premiering on VanityFair.com in September and on PBS in October. Danielle is the director of the Brooklyn Zen Center, and she's the co-founder and facilitator of Love Circle Sangha. Eric is a longtime community leader and teacher here at the New York Shambhala Center. He's a CFO as well, and has dedicated a large amount of time and energy to the Stonewall Foundation as well. Dr. Shantae Smalls is, is a teacher and a professor at St. John's. She contributes to a variety of organizations, including Amnesty International, the ACLU, and LGBT community at the LGBT Center. David's a friend of mine, and he's the director of Do I Sound Gay, which is available to watch on Netflix. It's a very inspiring film, and I would recommend that you all take a look. So we have some excerpts from our filmmakers' films here tonight. I'd like to start with David's film. When I first saw it, I thought it was so inspiring and so moving on a really practical, basic, heartfelt level, and I saw the time and effort and genuineness that went into making it, so I'm really grateful to have David here tonight. It's a beautiful piece of work and has a beautiful message, so we're going to show the opening.
Hi, it's Dave again. So we showed a clip from the beginning of the film, Do I Sound Gay, followed by another clip from Pink Boy. We're editing out those clips here for copyright reasons, and also movie clips don't tend to translate well to podcasts. Suffice it to say, Do I Sound Gay is on Netflix, and you can catch Pink Boy in the fall on VanityFair.com in September and PBS in October. Okay, now back to the panel.
Thank you both for bringing your work here. I really appreciate it. Really grateful to be able to show the endeavors that you've taken here to our community and to the center. So thank you both so much. I want to make sure everyone has access to a microphone. And can we just do like a...
Hello?
Yeah. Shantae, would you check?
Oh.
Hello.
Oh, I feel like half the battle's over because the video's played and the mics work. Maybe I can relax now. we just saw some work from Eric and David, and I'd like to open the panel up with them and ask, David Frehley and I titled this talk Queer Confidence, around the subject of self-acceptance and identity. And obviously you pose a lot of questions of identity here in your films, so I was wondering if you could speak to what the phrase queer confidence means to you.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you for having me, all of you guys. I chose this clip from the film because I think it shows that like queer confidence or confidence is not something that's stable and can be affected by, you know, whatever phase of your life you're in. And I found, and what the film is kind of about, is that my ability to deal with internalized homophobia or shame depended on, you know, how I felt about myself at that moment. And when things would be going poorly in my life, I would tend to start thinking, well, this is because you're gay. Like, this is what you're a bad person. So that was like too heavy. So the film is in a way to like show how, you know, something as simple as your voice and how you sound can start to feel like this very fundamental flaw in your entire being, because I was raised at a time when, you know, being gay was... I grew up in the South, and it was very taboo, and it was in the middle of the AIDS crisis, and, you know, so it was just a horrible, shameful, terrible thing. And so I guess I want to show how easily you could, if you'd kind of grown up with that kind of, in that situation, how you could kind of shoot back to it in a moment of where you're lacking confidence. And I don't know if you could hear it, but at the beginning of the film, I've just broken up with a boyfriend. I'm in my 40s, I'm single, and I'm like, well, there must be something wrong with me. It must have something to do with being gay.
Yeah, for me, I was really inspired to make the film because I started hearing stories about kids that were expressing their gender identity very early and parents that were letting them do it and go out in public, go to school. And that really inspired me because it made me start thinking about what would it be like if you grew up and you were never in the closet? And how would that affect your identity and your confidence and how you approach the world? And so I had this vision of like an entire generation of kids someday growing up that way. And, you know, these are just the early starts of it, obviously. Like, there's still a lot of people that aren't free to be themselves when they're growing up. But that was kind of the impetus for my film. You know, it deals with identity in a number of ways. And when I was filming, Jesse now is identifying as a girl, at the time was identifying as a boy, and was kind of in this in-between place, and had kind of an identity that would jump back and forth depending on the circumstances. So it was also kind of an exploration about how our identities do kind of transform over time as well.
Danielle, can I invite you to speak what queer confidence means to you?
Sure. It's an interesting question, and I reflected similarly to what Eric and David have shown. For me, before I started to identify as queer, basically my gender expression felt like a moving target. Like basically, some days I was received in a particular way. If whatever I was wearing, sometimes I was mistaken as a boy. And if I wore a dress, suddenly I'm being objectified. And that experience I internalized as somehow I was shifting. And queerness for me has just given me like a solid ground. You know, it's expansive enough and whole enough that I feel rooted in who I am and solid, and I can show up however I am, and that's still just fine.
I love that sense of expansiveness. I actually experience so much expansiveness when I'm learning from Acharya Spiegel. So I was wondering if you could speak to that sense of expansiveness that comes with self-acceptance.
Can I say what I want to say rather than just specifically that?
Please, your turn.
So I've been the whole, I feel like we're in such a fascinating time of where identity is becoming more open and more fluid, and the trans community suddenly manifesting in a public sphere. And it, to me, it mixes in with a lot of other things, such as Black Lives Matter and my own awareness of even as the, if you want to say the minority of being gay, just of still my white maleness and how much advantage I have experienced in my life, and just kind of, so for me, the, if you ask about expansiveness, it's really from a point of view of willing to, in every situation, try to listen and not walk into a situation and dominate it, but to give it space and let see what melodies come floating up and what stories come floating up and how other people can express themselves. So, because I guess just, and as me and as a teacher and as a leader in different communities, I feel like I'm always given that opportunity. So.
So thank you everyone for being here and coming out on a Wednesday night during Pride Week. And thank you to Georgia and David for organizing this event. And welcome to David and Eric and Danielle, our guests here at the Shambhala Center. And it's a really interesting question. One of the things I was thinking about watching sort of both films and then listening to the answers was that, you know, I sort of am in that in-between generation where I was out as a teenager. I was part of a queer youth group. I was able to date as a queer kid, as a teenager. And then I went to an all-women's college and, you know. But just thinking about in terms of the relationship to Dharma, or I feel like as a queer person, as someone who identifies as genderqueer, that like being a meditation practitioner also helps me to experience myself and my body in this really profound way. That's also sometimes scary, you know, as a queer person, as a queer person of color, you know, as a genderqueer person. And so a lot of times those identities are rendered precarious because of their kind of the ways that those categories are often violated, you know, whether by the state or other, you know, people. But I think Queer Confidence Index is this joy, you know, and I've been reading these things and like, you know, so now queerness is in the news in a different way than say gay marriage, and a lot of it, the mainstream news has this tinge of tragedy. And I don't mean related to Orlando, but that gayness itself is sort of like so tragic and so hard and so, or transness. So it's like, you know, it's so, it's automatically terrible. And I think, you know, kind of turning that around and saying that it's actually whatever, a gift or a possibility, or, you know, we can have lives filled with love, I think is super profound. And so that's, you know, that's what I've been thinking about since I've, y'all introduced the topic.
David, that brings up a point that I really experienced in your film, which is something so basic as your voice brings you into your body. And sometimes we're so uncomfortable being in our body because we're uncomfortable with ourselves. So I felt that your film was so accessible, not just from the vantage point of someone from an LGBT spectrum perspective, but just as a human being and finding confidence.
I'm glad you felt that. It was intended for everybody. I think that is related to what you're saying, Shantae. One of the ways that I sort of rediscover confidence and strength and pride about being queer is finding, you know, I do a lot of things. I sort of, you know, re-up with my friends and family, and they provide the reassurance that hopefully, you know, is available to everybody. I do a lot of learning about the queer voice and where it came from and linguistics behind it. But I also work on my voice, and one of the most transformative thing that happens in the film is that I kind of reconnect to my voice as a physical experience and rather as like an identity, kind of an intangible identity that I'm projecting, which is pretty much what you just said, that, you know, meditation brings you back to your body and the kind of seat of your queerness. I think that's how I heard it. So maybe that's why you brought me here tonight. But the film is self-reflective and mindful in that, it, you know, I kind of stumble my way there.
Eric, I understand that you have a long-time meditation practice. Has that informed your art and your projects?
Yeah, so I think I've noticed a change in how I approach film since I started meditating, for sure. Especially in documentary, I think you need to give space to your subjects and you need to allow them to have their lives kind of unfold in front of you. And I found myself much more able to do that from a mindful point of view and from meditation. Also, just as a documentarian, you go through what we call like the trough of despair, where you film all this stuff and then you have this feeling like, oh my God, I don't have a movie at all. What am I doing? I'm a complete failure. And it was definitely helpful during that period as well.
So it helped you find confidence to dig into the trough. And Danielle, you obviously work with Sangha a lot as a director of the Zen Center. Can you speak to how meditation has informed your relationship to your identity?
Sure. You know, with meditation, my initial experience with meditation was profound because I found community in a lot of ways. Through practice, I think that for me was empowering. It was empowering because I, oddly enough, just found a lot of queer people in Sangha, queer brown people. So that was really affirming. Also, specifically with practice, you know, for me, meditation has been. Has helped me become more attuned to my body and listening to what's happening in my body. And also in my heart and my mind. And so when I'm moving through the world and, you know, I might feel really crappy one day or feel vulnerable, I'm able to now take care of myself in those moments. So I might not outwardly look a particular way, but a lot's going on in here. And being able to recognize that and name that, and then that kind of opens the door to being able to take care of that, has allowed me to move through the world very differently. So yeah.
It's an endorsement.
It's great.
Thoughts on identity and meditation? Or whatever you'd like to say.
No, this is a good one. This is so the two photographs on the shrine are my two teachers, and Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche is the one that I met when I was, had just turned 19, and I went and met him and had a meeting, an interview or meeting with him, and the only thing that I remember from that meeting is that I asked the big question, and it was 1971, and I don't think we even had the word gay then. I'm not really sure, but I think I said something like, I'm homosexual. Is that okay? Is that going to be okay? And he was known for having a, I mean, he was known for a lot of things. One of the things, he's not, that he had a very high voice. And if you, you were talking about spaciousness. When you were in a room with him, it was extraordinarily spacious, and usually you forgot what you came to talk about. And so I got this big, my big question out. I'm queer. What? I was like, can I? Can you work with me here? And he said, I don't see any problem. And I just kind of took that as a go pass, and never really, it became not an issue for me, which is kind of a funny thing, actually, that it's, I think it may, all through my life, maybe it's been an issue for people around me, but it never occurred to me that it was especially an issue for me, that I could just be, I seem to have a disability that I'm not able to not be myself, sort of. So.
What was the question?
Thoughts on the relationship between meditation and identity, the relationship between meditation and confidence.
I want to say, first of all, this is, like, really fun, actually, listening to everyone, and it's a nice, it's always nice when we have a little bit of change in how things usually happen. But so last summer, I was about to go on retreat, and I was meeting with my meditation instructor, and I was having all this resistance to going on retreat at one of the land centers, Shambhala Mountain Center in Colorado, and it was just around the time of the Charleston murders, and I said to my meditation instructor, I don't know if I can sit in a tent filled with 200 white people and talk about basic goodness and not, I was like, you know, I don't know how, you know, how that's going to work, you know, and just saying that actually opened up some space for conversation. And then actually at the retreat, there ended up being some really incredible conversations, both with other black and brown people and white folks. And it was really, that conversation is still ongoing, and it was quite incredible. But I think part of meditation, I think sometimes, when I first started meditating, it was like, oh, I'm meditating, so that means that all of the kind of worldly stuff doesn't matter. But I bring my whole self into a situation. onto the cushion and into the sangha and into the world. And meditation practice really welcomes that. And so I think that even though I've been meditating for a while, it's still there's a tremendous amount of vulnerability to expose some concerns when you're in numerically the minority. But that's part of bravery, and that's part of confidence, is saying, yeah, I'm concerned. How do I do this? I don't know if I can do this. And so for me, identity is not a, it's an experience rather than something solid. And it changes as I accumulate experiences, as I hear different points of view. And sometimes that's awesome, and I welcome it, and sometimes I resist it because it feels quite scary.
One of the gifts that I feel like the Shambhala path and meditation has given me is a mirror to my fear. I feel like I'm able to not repress my fear as dramatically as I'm probably more capable of doing. But it's such a struggle with the world we live in when you're doing work to gain confidence, like whether it's something practical, like relating to the way you speak, or feeling an expansiveness of possibility, and to experience something like what happened in Orlando just can make you want to shut down and shutter up and call it quits. So I was wondering if I could ask you all to talk on, you know, what it's like to be confident, what queer confidence is like in a post-Pulse world. To you. No pressure.
Yeah.
Somber note.
We're really sticking to order. The order of the answering.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone thoughts that arise?
I'm going to pass because I've gone first twice, so. I'll just talk. I have the microphone.
Sorry.
My apologies. I was thinking about this a lot. I guess, as everyone was. In some ways, I feel like I have nothing to say about it. And I don't actually 100% know why that is. I mean, I have a kind of numbness around it and a lot of complicated feelings. I think one of the things I struggle with is, like, we tend to get invested in tragedies that feel like we can identify with. You know, these were other gay people. So on that level, there is, of course, that, for me, that identification. But I struggle with that versus, you know, why don't I feel that kind of on a daily basis for Syria or whatever, the people are killed every week by gun violence, which I know it's not what Orlando is about. But maybe because I do feel so strong, I do have a really strong reaction to it. I should have stuck with nothing as answer. But I don't know, I'm really struggling with it. I feel a little bit the way I feel about Prince. I don't know what to make of his death. I think it's just really hard to make sense of these tragedies that we feel connected to and have no connection to, in a way. And I also, I did... You know, AIDS was very much a part of my, what I grew up with, and sort of gay equaled death. And it hasn't felt like that to me for a long time, like that they were equated for me or for, you know, our culture has sort of moved, has grown so much since I was growing up that I haven't had to feel like such an equation, maybe. And suddenly I felt like that equation was back, like so... powerfully, and that, you know, it did make me think that how brave it is to be out, how every gay person is really courageous. And I was remembering when I came out at 19, how in awe I was of every gay person I met, because I was like, oh, you did it, like you came out, like that's amazing, you know. And I guess it's probably important to stay in touch with how brave it is on a daily basis to be gay, to be a woman, to be a person of color, all these things. Just a lot. I'll stop.
Thank you.
You know, I was at the club the same night in Brooklyn, you know, two clubs, which was a rarity. I was in bed quite early. But anyway, and I was, but it was interesting. The first club was friends of mine, it was their party, and I didn't notice it till afterwards, but I remember, you know, when I moved to New York in the late 90s, and queer clubs didn't always feel safe. I don't know if people remember, or, you know, I remember times going to Esquilita, and people knew that that was a gay club, a gay Latino club, and there were, you know, the space between, you know, getting into the club and out the curb sometimes was a dangerous thing, you know. Going to Esquilita, going to the Warehouse in the Bronx, going to Splash, going wherever, all Click Club when that was open, and Meow Mix. And so part of, sometimes the, like, getting to the club felt so unsafe. And one of the things I thought of after Pulse was how we used to sometimes have the taxi drivers drop us off a couple of blocks away from the club or a couple of blocks away from our house, you know, because reports of taxi drivers attacking gay people. And so I didn't have that sense when I was at, you know, for Brooklyn Pride. And but then I reflected later, there was a lot of security. It felt totally safe. We walked from one club in sort of desolate Brooklyn to the next club. I cried for 2 or 3 days, really, just thinking about you know, the devastation and the horror and all of that, and the kind of purposefulness of that, of Omar Mateen's rage, possibly self-loathing, you know, and that he targeted queer Latinos, you know, a queer Latinite. And I think queer confidence is, I think, making more space for conversation. I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but in some ways it's really easy to, like, analyze, and, you know, I've been doing, looking at all the police reports and, you know, the this and the that, but just allowing space to grieve and to be sad, and to be sad for the people who died and survived, and even the perpetrator. I think that that's really, really important, to not rush to the kind of adding more violence to the world and to the situation. So.
I too don't know quite what to say. I think it is really important to make space for holding our grief, and to make space for also celebrating those in our lives. You know, making time to be with one another. And I think that's true for the kind of painful emotions and despair that can arise with tragedy, and then also with our day-to-day lives. For myself, in the last few years, soon we'll be celebrating, or not celebrating, but observing the anniversary of Michael Brown's murder, and really, over the last couple years, I have spent a lot of time crying, spent a lot of time kind of being with despair, and I share that not to be down, but to say that it's important to take care of ourselves and allow space for that. And my experience getting the news of Orlando was having come off a retreat and coming back into the world and, you know, being thrust back into reality. And I watched myself, and I see that I'm different now with it. You know, I basically, the train went the wrong way, and I found myself at a Sangha gathering. And then that night, I, you know, chose to, like, sleep in a separate bed and not share the bed with my partner. And it was really important to just listen to myself. And then since then, I've shared a lot of joyful moments with people. So I think that balance is really important.
So, yeah, I really resonated with some of the things that David said about, you know, thinking back to the AIDS crisis and how our society has moved on and evolved since then. I think for me it was a tragedy, but the way the American public reacted to it was hopeful for me, and that gave me some amount of confidence that it felt like the majority of Americans were with us now and were supportive, and that gave me strength. I also think that this tragedy can be channeled in, you know, trying to take this hurt and this loss and channel it into positive ways, such as, you know, maybe this is when queer people really move into the gun debate, and there's, you know, groups starting like Gays Without Guns or Gays Against Guns, and ways of turning this tragedy into something that can cause positive change.
Yeah, thank you, both of you, actually. So I really feel, for me, this has been much more involved with the gun debate than the gay, lesbian situation. It really feels like it ties into Sandy Hook and into Charleston and just our inability to do anything proactive and meaningful. But as a Buddhist practitioner, my whole life has been about being willing to be vulnerable, be willing to have my heart open, and I completely refuse to not have my heart open and to be to put up a big wall and I don't go to clubs as a general tendency, but if I did, I would definitely continue to and I would. And I'm not a Baptist, but if I were, I would continue to practice at my church. And I'm not a first grader, but if I were, I would continue to go to first grade. So, and I feel that you can't, that the change has to happen from the point of view of, on the one hand, love as an overriding rule of not law, but kind of law that rules us, and that love and reason. So the reason aspect is the government's participation or need to step forward. And love meaning our own ability to recognize our fear and actually discover it and be willing to learn about it and not be afraid of our fear or of our vulnerability. So.
Thank you all. Bill?
Just a question.
I'd like to open it up for questions, and we'll begin with Bill.
Thank you. Just a question for the panel. One of the places that I tend to get stuck is dealing with hatred, whether you're thinking about racism or homophobia or other dimensions of hatred, many other dimensions of hatred. But I think what affects our community here has to do with homophobia or race or whatever particular communities we're a part of. But I just was wondering if you might share any thoughts that you have about, and I like this viewpoint from confidence, how do we relate to hatred, actually, direct hatred? Not that you have the answers for that, but just any thoughts that might be helpful to me. Thank you.
I don't have an answer to that, but I have a book that hit me like a bullet recently was Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, and what he does there is he expresses his rage without aggression, and that's something I've been trying to understand how it's done my whole life, is to have rage and separate it out from aggression, but just be willing to have the rage and express it clearly and invite people into it. And somehow, it's a book I just really exhort people to read, or to, the audio book is actually read by him, so it's really a beautiful voice.
I remember when I saw the trailer for Do I Sound Gay? And I was immediately intrigued, because I think that every boy, man, self-identified man is if they're gay, they're kind of forced to reconcile in many ways with the way their voice sounds. If it's, even when people call me today, sometimes they say, "Hi, man." You know, growing up as a kid, if you pick up the phone and they assume you're the mom or the sister, I mean, all of this kind of stuff. And he asked a question kind of about hatred, and I'm wondering, like, were you reconciling with self, in a way, a kind of self-hatred that I think a lot of gay men are still navigating, especially in terms of, like, a toxic masculinity that's overarching in terms of, like, when you are single, sometimes you're very self-critical and you're like, I need to present myself in this way because you no longer have that affirmative voice. I don't know what my question is. I mean, he was asking about hatred. So I guess almost, I do think there is a lot of self-loathing within the gay community occasionally. And I think what did you, working through that process, help you kind of break free from that, but also, like, how do you relate now when you're in groups of other gay men with stopping yourself from being like, there's those catty gays, because we do it all the time. I mean, like, you have the Fire Island example, and it's like, that's exactly what everybody's thinking. I mean, a lot of times we're all thinking that. We do it to each other, and sometimes it's playful and fun, and sometimes there's, like, something else that's there that's not fun.
Well, I think partly the film was inspired by the idea that it's not playful and fun, the way that sort of effeminacy gets sort of treated in gay culture, and both for ourselves and because it's, you know, sexism is kind of at the root of the issue, which is sort of fear of being a woman or fear of women. But the film is very much about self-hatred. It's about addressing, you know, why do I hate my voice? Why, you know, what's wrong with my voice? How did I learn that? It's also about externalized hatred. So there's a teenager in the film who was bullied and, like, kind of savagely beaten. and in school, and he was always targeted in part because he sounded like a girl. And so, I mean, it's interesting we're talking about confidence because in some ways you might think, well, like, why do we need confidence? Like, why should there even be a question of being confident? And I think it presupposes, or it speaks to the fact that we all know that the idea of queerness is kind of inherently undermined, and the sort of default status is that you're queer, you're different, you're other. How do you find the confidence to love yourself, to not feel that way? And I think I'm trying to answer your question because it was circuitous, so my answer is circuitous as well. But I think shame is very common for a lot of gay men. I think there are some very gifted and gay people, and there's some gifted people who, you know, like Dan Savage, who's in the film, who's like never felt shame, you know, like, and that I'm really in awe of that. I mean, there are people who really just, they don't have that gene or they didn't have that experience, and that's a beautiful thing to have never felt, you know, shameful about something that all of society has suggested you feel that way about. But I think one question for LGBT people and for all people is like, what's the antidote to shame? What's the balm? What's the redemption? And for a lot of us, it's love. You know, it's that love of community. It's that friendship. It's that partner. And that when you don't have that love or you don't feel that love is when the whole thing can start to topple. And because we live, I am wrapping this up, because we live in this kind of default status where we're not supposed to be confident and we always are, you know, need to sort of find a way to be confident, I think that there's a constant need for that balm and that redemption that is sort of maybe somewhat, is both unique to LGBT people and very universal.
Before coming here, I was thinking about also my experience of being queer and identifying as queer has been like humanizing, and has been kind of through it. I've been able to kind of to recognize the name and name the parts or the habits that I have where I'm silencing myself, or I'm, you know, basically buying into the fact that I'm not a full human being, be it because of my sexuality or my gender or my color, or the color of my skin. And I think at the root of hatred is a lot of hatred that we're experiencing currently as a country and in our communities is the fact that we're not treating each other as humans. You know, there, as you know, one example is just I've started a practice of just acknowledging people who are around me in public settings. Even if I'm not looking them in the eye, I'm taking stock of who's there. Because oftentimes there are certain people, certain groups of people, certain energies of people that I don't notice, or that I don't even look at. And so I think it's important for us to, you know, I think that is a loving act, you know, to just to make space for the bodies and the energies that are around us.
Not so much a question as just a comment on how joyful it is to have this conversation and to be together. And that love certainly is an antidote for shame, but also the ability for us to be able to have the courage to talk together is I think equally important to love. And it feels like that as a society, it's what we're hurting most is that we can't talk. And the often binary roles, particularly as a man that I, and as a gay man that I feel and witness in the type of work that I do, where I work with a lot of men of different identities. And it's not, it's what continues to make my heart ache is how we get stuck in such limited gender roles that seems to be organized by shame. And the confidence to have this conversation is an invitation to take the conversation out. You know, I've heard, and we've all heard at some point or another, the invitation that we have perhaps being marginalized, having had the experience of different marginalizations, that's also an opportunity to become healers. And I think the more courage that I have to be able to speak, the more courage that each of us has to speak is an opportunity to perhaps build confidence. So thank you, everybody, for Bill for organizing this, I guess, if you were one of them.
Mm-hmm. It's your turn.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you. I'm not sure if this is fully formed, but I was thinking about, I was kind of stuck on something you said about the voice, and that I was stuck on something that, I forget your name, David said about the voice, and that part of what was vulnerable in it and subject to attack was the effeminacy of the voice, or like the, and, it really resonated with some of my experiences in Dharma spaces, being kind of anti-femme and feeling that there's, you know, I just had this thought, like, well, why am I not more vocal about my queer identity in Dharma spaces, and realizing that, you know, it sexualizes me in a way that is not, doesn't seem to be okay to bring into spiritual spaces. And so I kind of just am interested in anyone's thoughts about that, about being a sexual being in a Dharma space, about being a whether female bodied or having an effeminate, you know, form of sexuality, in a space that I think, you know, the Dharma survived kind of through aligning itself with a patriarchy, and so it, you know, it's it, we have that legacy still today, and I feel it.
I don't know if I have anything definitive to say about that, but I did have that experience. I was at a meditation center in Burma, and I found myself kind of almost unconsciously going back in the closet and not really knowing why, and then realizing that I had some thought that the teacher was not going to accept me if he knew that I was gay. And, you know, which very well could be the case in some cases. In that case, I was wrong. And actually, my partner came at the end of my retreat to the center, and we had an audience with the teacher, and it was such not an issue that I realized that it was all kind of in my head. So I do think that there are definitely spaces that are not friendly, and then there's also spaces where we put that, we impose that on ourselves. And, you know, I think always, you know, looking to see where it's coming from is important for me.
Thank you for that question. I've observed that I feel like feminine energy, both sort of in a spiritual way and also feminized or feminine presentation, a lot of times gets kind of ignored or put to the side or seen as less valuable. in a dharmic context. And that's, you know, I've had conversations with people over the years about that. And, you know, you just saying that is also making me think about how I choose to present myself, like when I teach or when I'm at, you know, and it's usually more masculine or gender neutral. And, you know, that's now giving me a lot of pause about what commands power and who commands power. And, but I think also, you know, being a queer person, there's that other side of it where we're also sometimes rendered as predators. And sometimes for me, I feel like I don't have, I don't have confidence in the situation that, you know, I kind of expect the homophobia, the queerphobia. And so, you know, I've internalized some of those messages still. I don't have an answer, but I think your question is actually really super important. And I think it's something that the Sangha has to make the space safe. You know, it's not up to the individual to kind of, you know, bulldoze or, like, we have to be really open and really welcoming and really honoring. And I think that's really hard, you know. It's really easy to replicate exactly what's in everyday society. It's really easy. It's like we don't have to think about it. So I just want to thank you for asking that question because it's actually helped me. It's brought it to the forefront of my mind.
I'll be brief. Hi, my name is Daniel. And one of my favorite phrases that's come out of the Black Lives Matter movement is stay woke, right? And I've been trying to engage this idea of being awake to this tragedy in Orlando and to the series of tragedies of police violence and brutality against black bodies and queer bodies and trans bodies. And I also grew up in the 70s and 80s, so I remember Reagan-era AIDS, but also the constant threat of nuclear war and this, like, deep sense it could come at any time. So I guess the question is, how does one practice being awake, being aware of the possibility of death at any moment for oneself or for a community or for others without getting hard? You know, without getting, and I'm really struck by your example of post-Charleston getting ready to go to this retreat and that thing come. You know, I come from a long line of paranoid black people where it's like, you know, we're ready to fight. So, you know, I'm trying to let that down a little bit, yeah.
I think what I guess what I didn't share earlier, over the last years, I've also been awake to my fear of being eliminated. And that's partly from like a specific experience of being arrested for no reason in my neighborhood. And it's also from just kind of being awake, right? Like being on my Facebook page, seeing things day in and day out. And I think, you know, the world is kind of on this trajectory that we can't control in some ways. And violence in some ways we can't control outside of ourselves. And I think we can just practice with taking better care of our fears, right? Practice with taking better care of this despair. And it's not compartmentalizing. And what I found is that it's not compartmentalizing. It's kind of just seeing the yin and yang in what we're carrying. So sometimes I'm feeling joy, and I'm actually sad. Or sometimes I'm totally devastated, and you know, I see a friend, and suddenly I'm beaming. So I don't know if that's helpful, but.
Just going back to what I said earlier, I'm kind of just so fascinated by this time of identity, of identity shift. And my sort of first awakening to it actually was like about 3 years ago. My friend Eve Rosenthal and I were teaching a LGBTQ weekend in Colorado. And we were arriving and registering at Shambhala Mountain Center, and there was this other couple who were arriving, and I didn't realize they were for our program. And one was a very tall person with shoulder-length hair, gentle breasts, and a prominent Adam's apple. And and the other person was a woman who turned out that was they were coming to our weekend and also celebrating their 25th anniversary, which had started in a very different trajectory. And I just feel, for me, Danielle said earlier, there are so many people I don't see, you know, and I'm very aware of, I've always been fairly aware of how that probably 90% of people, I really notice the people I'm attracted to or don't, disattracted to, and probably 90% of the rest are in that gray zone that it's actually really hard to notice. But I'm so taken by people's presentation of themselves and how they do their hair or don't do their hair or what they wear or how they hold themselves up or down or in or out, you know. And so to me, that's been kind of my sort of an inner journey that I've been taking over the last few years of just discovering how many different stories there are. Not just our life story, but our heritage stories and what creates us. So,
awesome. Thank you. So I can't express the gratitude I have for each of you for coming here this evening and being with us and our community and for being so open-hearted and brave and confident and intelligent and graceful and elegant. Thank you for letting me fumble through my first panelist experience here with a lot of kindness and gentleness. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a friend of the podcast. Tell your friends about the podcast. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to live in the New York City area, come by, visit us. Our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night is a great place for newcomers to drop in, hear the kinds of talks that you hear on this podcast in person. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up, and we'll catch you next time. Later.